Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Gerard Artson, who has recently written a book about George Adamski. It's called A Herald for the Space Brothers, and this is obviously what we are going to discuss today. So, welcome to the program, Gerard.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome, and I would thank you again for making yourself available at pretty short notice, which was very
useful. It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Yes.
Now, I'm sure my listeners would like to know a little bit about your background, and particularly why or how you became interested in George Adamski, because his experiences go back to the 1950s as far as seeing flying craft and having contact with ETs.
Yes, exactly. And, well, I wasn't even born yet when his major contacts started. I was born in 1957, and I've worked as a translator for quite a long time in my professional life until about 10 years ago when I decided to become a teacher. And I now teach at the Teacher Training College here in Amsterdam. But what started my interest in George Adamski was not even when I first read his what I would call his major book, Inside the Spaceships, that was published in 1955, and that I can tell you a bit more about in a minute. About 30 years ago, maybe 33 years ago, I became interested in what are known as the Ageless Wisdom Teachings. And
yes.
It started with a book that I bought by Jiddu Krishnamurti and another book by Alice Ann Bailey, The Consciousness of the Atom. And through the Ageless Wisdom Teachings, the main body of those teachings was given from 1875 onward by Madame Blavatsky, and then Alice Bailey from 1919 through 1949. She wrote about 19 books, and mainly an elaboration on the teachings given first by Blavatsky. And more recently, and there have been other disciples, as they are called, who convey the teachings of the Masters of Wisdom. Most recently, Benjamin Cram in London. And as I found out more and more about those teachings, I thought it would be useful to compile a catalog to sort of remember for myself where I could find what. But that sort of grew and grew, and then finally I decided to publish that catalog online in 2008 with the technology making that possible. While I was doing my research for the catalog, I came across George Adamski's first book, and that was called Wisdom of the Masters of the Far East. And, of course, if people have heard of Adamski, they know about his books, about flying saucers and his experiences with the space people. But until that time, until I came across his first book, I didn't know he had a connection with the Masters of Wisdom and with the wisdom teachings. So then my interest in his work was really sparked, and I managed to obtain some of the more obscure, unknown publications, because he's written a lot more than just the three books about UFOs that most people know him about, know him of. And that gave me an insight in his view of life into the teachings that he was given by the space people, his space contacts. And I saw through my study of the teachings that I knew about already through Blavatsky, etc., so many parallels and similarities that I felt I couldn't keep that to myself, and I had to write this down and make it available to a wider audience. And so that's how I came to write this book.
Right. Do you link his background or his knowledge in any way with the fact that he had this contact with the Venusians?
Yes, absolutely. I believe he was prepared for this very what turned out to be a very, very difficult mission. He was prepared for that by his training as a teenager with the Masters of Wisdom in Tibet. He was arranged to be sent there by someone who I think was a space person when he was a child, because his father died when he was very young, and the family had just emigrated to the United States and was very, very poor. But on that journey from Poland, where the family came from, the Adamski family, to the United States, they were befriended by what was called a tall, dark stranger. And this person became a friend of the family, and after George's father had passed away, he sort of took the paternal responsibilities upon himself. And when George turned 12, he arranged for him to be sent to Tibet. And I believe he was prepared there for his mission to prepare the world, to inform the world of people living, all the planets being inhabited, and people from other planets visiting our planet, the Earth.
Right. I have no recollection of the details, but I seem to recall that when people did what you did, sort of look behind Adamski to see what he was made of, they weren't necessarily in favour of what they found. He was sort of criticised, and some sort of rather, I think, unfortunate remarks made about him. Now, do you relate to that at all? Did you find that in your research, that he was maligned or whatever?
Oh, absolutely. He was maligned to a fault. He was not spared any kind of lie, half-truth, rumor, gossip. All kinds of stories were told about him. There was an actual character assassination going on, especially, so I think, because he became very popular. A lot of people now don't even remember his name, and certainly the younger generations have never heard of George Adamski. But at the time when his books came out, his first book, for instance, which was a cooperation between him and Desmond Leslie, Lord Desmond Leslie, an Irish Englishman, had written a historical account of the UFO phenomenon, going all the way back to the ancient Indian Veda writings, scriptures, yes. And giving an overview up until the present day of that time, 1953. And when he heard about George Adamski's encounter in the desert, California desert, in 1952. He proposed that his report, Adamski's report, would be combined with his own work, and so it became a combined publication, Flying Saucers Have Landed.
Yes.
And that was followed 2 years later by Inside the Spaceships, which is a longer report by Adamski of his meetings with these people in the spacecraft. He was taken aboard motherships. He was allowed to speak to many of the crew and received teachings from highly evolved beings from Venus and other planets. And people were so interested. The audiences that came to his lectures were massive, and by 1959 a world lecture tour had been arranged, and that took Adamski to South America, Australia, New Zealand, and Europe, many different countries in Europe, and that got the authorities worried, and from then on a disinformation campaign was started, and he was debunked, he was defamed, he was ridiculed to no end, and the result is, even now, that many people who know that UFOs and the extraterrestrial presence are a reality still refrain from referring to Adamski for fear of being ridiculed themselves.
Yes. I do recall that particular period. I had left school in the very late 1940s, and you may recall through your research that that really was the period when there were lots of flying saucer flaps, when Colin Fry, who had an earlier sighting than Adamski, saw this bell-shaped scout ship, which was Venusian, and it was a very difficult time, I think, for anybody that came out in favour of the sightings, although, like now, there were many photographs taken and lots of witnesses. So I can imagine that would have been a very difficult time for Adamski, but no doubt, as has happened over many years since that time, the governments have tried to hide up the facts. As you said, they put out disinformation as well. So it's made it very difficult for anyone who's had actual experiences to relate them to people. Now, were you originally interested in the flying saucer phenomena anyway?
Yes, I was. I have always found it fascinating to think that we would be contacted by beings from other worlds, that there would be communication between the different worlds through, you know, people who, with their more highly advanced technology, would be able to come to Earth. And I've always dreamt of being taken aboard a saucer or a spaceship to be shown around the solar system, or perhaps a bit further than that. It hasn't happened to me yet, but I'm staying hopeful.
Yes. I mean, have you had any personal sightings that you can absolutely take for certain that were extraterrestrial craft?
No, I'm afraid not. I have had a very extraordinary sighting many years ago. That was in 1980 or 1981. And I was in Nepal at the time. I used to travel. I traveled as a backpacker around Asia and in other parts of the world. And this time I was in Nepal. And one morning, I had persuaded one of my best friends from Holland, where I obviously was born and grew up, to come and join me on that trip. And it was early morning. And I was, you know, sitting outside my room and looking into the sun that was just rising, so it wasn't, you know, too bright, and you could see the disc, the solar disc, against the sky, blue sky, clear sky, until just after a short while, it seemed to be moving away from itself. So I saw one disc moving away in front from another disc, away from another disc that was behind it. And the one that stayed behind must obviously have been the sun, because the sun doesn't usually travel that fast across the sky. And the disc that was moving, it was the same size and almost the same color. And I had called my friend over, and that's why I know I saw that what I saw, because he said, "Don't tell me that. Don't point this thing out to me. I don't remember exactly what he said, but he just didn't want to have to deal with it, because he couldn't believe what he saw, and I was fascinated. But at the time, I didn't quite relate it to a UFO sighting. But I think now, especially because quite recently, there's been images from a Taiwanese news program where they showed exactly the same thing of two solar disks very near each other, and that's exactly what I saw in 1980 or 81 in Nepal. But I've never seen a bell-shaped saucer or anything, and I would love to, because, you know, it's the iconic, especially through George Adamski's photographs, it's the iconic image of a scout ship flying saucer.
Yes, it's funny really, because I seem to get the impression that apart from those early sightings of these particular type of scout craft, they seem to gradually die away, and I can't even say if in recent times that particular craft has been seen again. But they were very much in evidence at the time when Adansky had his sightings and took his photographs, of course. Now,
I quite agree with you there, except that there are reports, not quite as often and as many as in the late 1940s and in the 50s of those saucer-shaped or bell-shaped saucers. But you do hear of them and see photographs from time to time. Not quite as often, but they're still around, apparently. But I suppose the technology and the designs of the space people advance just as our own technology advances.
Right, yes. I still have my original copy of The Flying Saucers Have Landed, the one that was co-edited by Leslie and Adamski, and I recall there was always a very interesting section in that, which I haven't seen repeated elsewhere. They gave, as it were, a catalogue of sightings from the 1600s right through to the beginning of the last century. And it's surprising when you look back to see just how many sightings have taken place. And these, of course, are only the ones that have been recorded and available for people doing the research. So they've been with us for a long, long time. What do you think about that? I mean, do you think they've been coming to the Earth for not just hundreds of years, but thousands?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I see no reason why they wouldn't have been coming to visit us and perhaps assist if necessary ever since time began or ever since humanity appeared on the face of the earth. There's many references in the Bible to columns of fire and columns of smoke or what they are called, that I think Leslie also refers to those. Ezekiel especially is a famous episode in the Old Testament that many people believe refers to UFO activity. And in fact, there's, I don't know if you've heard of the Italian contactee Giorgio Di Bitonto. He wrote about his experiences. The experiences took place in 1980 and onward, and he published his book in Italian in 1983, and it was translated into English and published in 1990. And he also gives many references to UFO activity in biblical times, which are confirmed, in fact, by his space contacts. So I'm absolutely certain that the people who have been able to travel around the solar system have done so all throughout history.
Yes, and indeed, I find it quite surprising that some people have looked at older paintings going back a few hundred years, and they have found what we can now identify as flying craft very cleverly hidden in the paintings, which does seem to confirm their presence was known at that time. I mean, whether they understood that they came from outside, possibly of the solar system or from another planet, it maybe is debatable. But what do you think the link is between UFOs today and what we're experiencing, which generally people see as immense changes, which many believe, including myself, will lead to some type of ascension?
I actually think that's exactly why the UFOs are here, why the space people are coming to Earth. They are here not to arouse curiosity or anything, or because they were done visiting other planets. They're here in support of the historic happenings, historic events, the transformation that's taking place on our planet. the humanity, I believe, based on my study research of the Ages Wisdom teachings, is on the verge of awakening from its cosmic slumber, as it's been called, and George Adamski and his space contacts refer to it in those terms. Because for many, many centuries and thousands of years, we've lost our cosmic connection, and we are now at a point in our evolution as mankind, as humanity on this planet, where we will reconnect, we will rediscover in a way the spiritual realities of life, and reconnect with the cosmos. Of course, if on other planets people have evolved to a degree that Adamski described in his book Inside the Spaceships, his second main book about UFOs, then the same must be going on our planet, except other planets may be ahead of us in that sense. But indeed, yes. If you look at the teachings coming from Blavatsky and Alice Bailey and Benjamin Krem, you see that the teachings say life is not a chemical accident on this planet, but it's the source of all being. It's the source of all that is. And it expresses itself through the evolution of consciousness. Yes. Now, humanity is only halfway station, so to speak, of that evolution of consciousness. We are the meeting ground between the meeting ground where matter and spirit meet, and that's where self-consciousness comes into play. And but it's not the crown. We are not quite the crown of creation, as we've been taught to believe. Or there are higher kingdoms in nature, spiritual kingdoms above the human kingdom. And the first up from the human kingdom is the spiritual kingdom, the kingdom of souls, where we find the masters of wisdom on our planets. The masters of wisdom have come to a point in their own evolution that they have to return as a group to the everyday world. When the last main part of Atlantis was destroyed, according to the teachings, the masters, some 98,000 years ago, the masters had to withdraw, or they chose to withdraw to the remote mountain and desert centers of the world, like the Himalayas and the Gobi and the Urals and the Rocky Mountains, the Andes, etc. So humanity was left to its own devices for quite a while, with the masters only sending out teachers, one from among them, into the world from time to time to inspire humanity for a certain age, civilization at for that age, etc. But now, with the humanity realizing how small the global village really is and how interconnected everything is on our planet, we've reached that point where humanity and the kingdom of souls, the masters of wisdom, will be back in touch with each other and will be consciously working together. The masters, of course, have never lost sight of humanity, but humanity has lost sight over the centuries of their spiritual mentors and exemplars. Because this development was announced first by Madame Blavatsky, who first introduced the notion of the existence of the masters of wisdom and the evolution of consciousness in her works in 1875. And Alice Bailey wrote, for instance, the book, very important book, The Reappearance of the Christ, in which she explains and connected the different expectations in the major religions for the next revelation, to humanity. And according to Benjamin Cram, this is now, he's an esotericist and artist in London, and he's been working since 1975 to inform the world of this imminent return of our elder brothers, the Masters of Wisdom, with the world teacher, the master of all the masters, at their head. And so indeed, yes, the these are historical times, and this breakthrough in consciousness, if you will, it's like an initiation almost for the planet, which of course is accompanied by upheavals in the physical nature of the planet itself. And one of the main reasons for the UFOs to come to Earth is to assist in mitigating the effects. And in fact, Benjamin Cram has said that in the late 1970s, the space people have put around our planet a ring of light so that it won't completely tilt the axis, the Earth's axis won't completely tilt. It has shifted a little bit, but within limits, it is going to stay intact so that there won't be any major catastrophes. Of course, there will be upheavals such as we've recently seen in New Zealand and Japan, but they will be limited. And the space people have actually developed a technology, it seems, in which they with which they are able to implode energy from major earthquakes. And Benjamin Cram has said that they've recently first applied this technique when in April, after the earthquake that hit the northeast of Japan, on the 7th of April, Tokyo was hit by an earthquake, 7.5 earthquake. Yes. But the effects of that earthquake were mitigated by this new technology that the space people have used there, and it was seen, it was reported on the news as a blinding blue light when that earthquake struck. Yes, they're here to help us through this time of transition.
Yes, that's wonderful news. Talking of Benjamin Cram, I did in fact attend his meetings for a while, which he held in London, going back a few years now. And I recall that at every meeting, the Maitreya used to enter his body and come through to the audience there. And Benjamin Cram is an exceedingly nice person, and his meetings were very highly spiritual.
Yes, he well. If I may correct you there, it's not so much that Maitreya entered Benjamin Cram's body, but there's a. It was a more a kind of mental overshadowing, in which through which Maitreya conveyed his message. By he was allowed. If of course it's a matter of. Giving permission for your body to be used. So Maitreya overshadowed Benjamin Cram and then gave his messages. And Maitreya, of course, is the personal name of the master of all the masters, the world teacher. And Benjamin Cram, just to finish this for listeners who haven't heard of this before, Maitreya is the world teacher is the coming one. He's seen as the Imam Mahdi in certain departments of Islam. He's expected by the Jews as the Messiah and the 10th incarnation of Vishnu by the Hindus, etc., etc. And he's begun his first public interviews on TV in America last year. He's had several dozen already in the United States and seven, I believe, in Mexico. And this, according to Benjamin Cram, signals his open return into the world's arena. And within a few years, everybody will know that he's here and everybody will know who he is. Without a doubt, and it is in that respect that the space people are here to support that, because it will mean a major shift in perception of life for humanity, to see that life doesn't end when the body dies, and there's a whole we're all involved together in this journey, this of evolution, and this journey of you know, growing consciousness, and it's going to change people's perception of life to a massive degree.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to look forward to. Now, the Maitreya part, who are the other masters of wisdom, and where do they come from?
The masters of wisdom come from humanity. Whenever a person, a human being, has entered the final stages of the path of evolution on this planet, he goes or she goes through a series of crises in consciousness, expansions of consciousness, called initiations. This is all information based on the teachings, again, especially from Alexander Bailey. And the initiations are, in fact, and this is an interesting part, were illustrated in the life of Jesus. And that was one of the purposes of Jesus' life and the recording of his life. There are five initiations that lead a man, a person, to masterhood. And we're talking about mastering our lower nature. And the first was illustrated in the gospel by the birth of the of Christ in the cave of the heart. So it's really to do with the birth of the Christ consciousness. The second initiation was illustrated by the baptism in the River Jordan, and that signifies or illustrates the conquering our fluid nature, our astral emotional nature. The third initiation is the transfiguration on the mount, and that is to do with mastering our mental nature and becoming for the first time identified with our souls, with our divine soul. The fourth initiation was exemplified in the crucifixion, the great renunciation, in which we sacrifice our lower nature. And the fifth initiation, the resurrection, shows the liberation, the definitive final liberation of spirit from matter. And with the fifth initiation, the person becomes the master of wisdom and enters the kingdom of souls. It's no longer bound by the laws of karma or reincarnation. You don't have to reincarnate anymore. Mind you, these five initiations are not taken in one life. A whole series of lifetimes are necessary to complete that last stage of the journey, but it's relatively short compared with the hundreds of thousands of lifetimes that we've spent coming to the point, coming up to the first initiation. So the masters come from humanity. They are a product of humanity, and they have, as I said, from the destruction of Atlantis, have remained in their remote mountain and desert centers, and from there working through their disciples in the world, inspiring scientists, artists, musicians, philosophers, politicians, you name it, to help humanity forward on its way. And and now is the time that the masters, some of which are very well known, will be coming back into the world. Many people think and see Jesus as the Christ or the world teacher, but in fact, Jesus was a disciple of the Christ, of Maitreya, and just as the Buddha worked through his disciple, Prince Gautama, 500 years before Jesus was born, Maitreya overshadowed his disciple Jesus. And in his next life, as Apollonius of Tyana, Jesus became a master of wisdom himself. So we have Maitreya, the master of all the masters. We have the master Jesus, who is in Rome now. In 1975, there were five masters who were the first to take their places in the world, before even Maitreya returned arrived in his modern center in the world, in London. Those are the five great spiritual centers, New York, Geneva, Darjeeling, and Tokyo. Those are the five, according to the teachings, the five main spiritual centers on our planet. And in 1975, a master arrived in each of those centers. In 1977, according to Benjamin Graham's information, Maitreya arrived in London and started his activities there to slowly, gradually emerge into the public eye, which is now coming to culmination within a very short period of time. But in 1980, two more masters entered their centers in the world, one in Rome, and that was the Master Jesus, and one in Moscow. And by now there are 14 masters who have taken their places in the world already. We don't know exactly where all of them are. But for instance, the Master Joel Kuhl, among the students of the Aces Wisdom Teachings, is a very familiar name because he is the master who gave the teachings through Alice Bailey, for instance.
Yes.
The masters Kuthumi and Moria are quite well known because of their work through the Theosophical Society. So there are quite a few masters that we all know and have heard about. And they will be introduced to the world by Maitreya after he has had his worldwide declaration.
Has he indicated yet when that wide world declaration would be?
There have been several points in time since 1977 when that was possible. One notable point in time was 1982, the late spring of 1982, when through a worldwide advertisement campaign, the groups working with Benjamin Graham try to alert the media's attention to Maitreya's possible imminent emergence. The media, unfortunately, didn't respond with sufficient clout, so to speak, so it had to be postponed. But the indicator, because there have been some developments recently, that started in December 2008 with the appearance in the skies of what are referred to as modern-day stars of Bethlehem, and they are apparently four enormous spacecraft commissioned from other planets in our solar system, and they sort of fulfill the same role as the Star of Bethlehem, and they are meant to alert the world's attention to the coming of the new teacher. And if you look on YouTube, for instance, there are many video clips uploaded by people not at all related or connected with Benjamin Graham, wondering what this bright star-like object is, and they can tell it's not really a star, but it's because it's brighter than a star. But it sometimes it moves, sometimes it changes color or shape, and there's four of those positioned around the planet, and they when they had sort of garnered enough attention from December 2009, Maitreya started his public interviews on American television. As I said, that has been going on, and the number of interviews will continue, and he will give interviews in other countries as well. And the interesting thing is that in America, when he's interviewed, he will be speaking English. In Mexico, when he's interviewed, he's speaking Spanish. And when next he's being interviewed in Japan, he will be speaking Japanese. So the interviews will continue, and the interest of the people and the media will be increasing. And within, I believe, personally, based on my involvement with this information, that it will not be more than a few years before this worldwide declaration will take place. And everybody, through an unbelievable event when Maitreya will speak to the whole world through the TV stations that will be connected throughout the world through satellites. And everybody will see him on TVs, on their TV screens, and hear his message. But while as we see his face on TVs, his lips won't be moving. But everybody will be hearing his, because he will be mentally overshadowing, and this is going to be unique in the history of the world. He will be mentally overshadowing all of humanity at the same time. And that makes it possible for him to convey his message, which will go on for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, to everyone in their own language. So you will hear his message in English, and me as a native Dutch speaker, I will hear his message in Dutch. The Japanese will hear it in Japanese, the Russians in Russian, the French in French, etc., etc. And in that short period of 15, 20 minutes, Maitreya will give us an experience of our high origins, our source, our spiritual source, and will show the depths to which we have fallen, and the long journey that we've made as mankind back to this point, and the brilliant future that lies ahead. And at the same time, hundreds of thousands of spontaneous healings will take place. And his energy also, the world teacher, the Christ or the Messiah or whatever you want to call him, is the embodiment of love on this planet, the energy of love, the cosmic energy of love. And during this period of 15, 20 minutes, his love will stream out in such force, such strength, that he said it will feel like I embrace you. So we will actually feel it physically. And in those three ways of hearing his message in our own language without him speaking on television, feeling his enormous, powerful energy of love and those spontaneous healings, those three ways, we will know that that man and only him is the world teacher for the new age, the age of Aquarius. He will also introduce, maybe not during his brief declaration, the existence of the Space Brothers. I actually expect that he will, but he might keep it until shortly after that. Certainly, he will introduce the Master Jesus and perhaps some other masters. And once the world knows about his existence and the existence of the masters, of course, after he will be at the center of the world for the whole of the coming age, the age of Aquarius, which is roughly 2,500 years. So, people will want to know more. They will want to know more about the nature of life and the masters, and the world teacher will be here to teach us quite openly and quite directly. So it will inaugurate a whole new phase in the evolution of life on this planet.
Right. With the knowledge that you have, did you find many parallels between the ageless wisdom teachings and the teachings that Adamski dealt in?
Absolutely, and especially the teachings as Adamski was given from the space people, by the space people, and that was, as I said, the reason for me to write this book. In his early teachings, in his first booklet that was published in 1936, it's a very thin booklet actually, but it's brilliant in how it summarizes the teachings that, for instance, Madame Blavatsky wrote very big volumes about. And Adamski does it in, I don't know exactly, 36 or 48 pages or something. Of course, not to the same level of detail, but the core of the teaching is really there in a very thin booklet. And then when he meets with the space people, which he describes in his book Inside Spaceships. The teachings that they give about the need for humanity to live in with respect for fellow beings, with respect for the earth, the need for harmlessness, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them to you. He conveys it so vividly in his book. Obviously, he wasn't there sitting in a Venusian mothership taking notes, and certainly we didn't have, as Earth humanity, we didn't have computers, so he didn't bring a laptop or anything that we find quite normal now. So he was given those teachings, and only after he returned to his home could he sit down and write them down. But they're so vivid, and especially in the more obscure publications, the smaller publications that were only sent to people who had subscribed to them. You may remember from my book that in 1957, the space people suggested that Adamski set up a movement, a circle of friends around the world. That would be informed by their national contact. So in each of the countries where Adamski went, had been to a lecture, and where he had contacts, he would be sending his information, and those people would be translating it and sending it on to the people in their respective countries. And right. So there were many people who subscribed to these bulletins, but of course not quite as many as there were people who bought his books that were available in the bookshops. But in those publications, in those bulletins, he gave many more details, and it's fascinating to see how much, to what great degree and extent they chime in with the teachings of the Ages Wisdom.
Right. Just as a point of interest, I did read at some time, going back quite a few years now, that where some people were contacted by extraterrestrials and they saw them come out of the craft, they were convinced that one of them was the return of George Adamski. He looked younger. But I thought that was interesting as well.
Yes, and I was amazed when I first read that. This actually was published in a book called The Skorriton Mystery.
Oh, yes.
Yes, this was an episode where an Englishman, Ernest Bryant, if I remember his name correctly, stopped on his way, and he was walking along the moors. I believe, when he saw a saucer landed, and even though he was startled and was a bit frightened, he decided to stay put, and then he saw three beings come out, one of them indeed being much younger than the others, and this was the day after George Adamski had died.
Oh, was it? Yes.
In America, yes, this was the next day. George Adamski died on the 23rd of April, 1965, St. George's Day, coincidentally. The 24th of April, according to Ernest Bryant in this book, The Skorriton Mystery, was contacted by this being who stepped out of a scout ship. And the only conclusion that researchers could come to was that this must have been George Adamski in a different manifestation, or the being who lived on Earth as George Adamski in a different manifestation, saying he was Venusian, asking Bryant to contact Desmond Leslie. And the interesting thing is that this similar thing happened to Giorgio Di Bitonto, the contactee, Italian contactee that I just mentioned before, who was contacted by the same people that Adamski described in his book Inside the Spaceships. And you may remember that Adamski said in Inside the Spaceships that he chose the names for those people himself. But Giorgio Di Bitonto met by people who use those same names that Adamski had given in his book. And then at one point, he was introduced to what one of his space contacts said was their brother. His name is George, and he lived for a while on Earth, where he came to work on a mission. So apparently that was George Adamski again, who was there introduced to a fellow contactee, Giorgio Di Bitonto. So it happened twice, in fact. And yes, that's the reason why I think George Adamski was, in fact, a person from Venus, an individual from Venus, yes, who incarnated on Earth for the specific purpose of introducing to our humanity here, to introducing to our planet the notion of life on other planets, and then the reality of their visits.
I'm sure you're absolutely right on that point. Now, Gerard, we're coming to the last few minutes of the program, and I want you to take a couple of minutes, if necessary, to give people details of where they can find out information about you and how they can purchase your book. So go ahead.
Thank you very much. The book, as you said at the beginning of the program, is called George Adamski, A Herald for the Space Brothers. If people want to know a bit more about it or about me, they can go to my website, www.bgapublications.nl. And on that website, they'll also find links to amazon.com for the or amazon.co.uk or any of their websites to order the English edition. There's a Dutch translation in case there are any Dutch listeners, but there's links there as well. And the website also has various links to articles that I've written and that have been published in English, and some of them translated, because I keep following up on my research into Adamski, and obviously I'm working on a new book now that I hope will be out by the end of this year, but I'm not making any promises yet. but yeah, on the via my website, people can keep track of my latest writings.
Right. What would the subject be of your new book?
It will actually focus on all the evidence that I'm gathering now that there is no threat in the extraterrestrial visits and people from other planets coming to Earth. They're here only to help, to assist us, to mitigate the effects of our ruining and polluting the planets. The planet, and to prevent nuclear pollution and radiation from destroying the fabric of life on this planet to a great degree. Without their help, life would be much less bearable on Earth. There's every evidence that shows that there's nothing alien about the visitors from space. That's why I never use the term alien. I only refer to them as space people or extraterrestrials.
Yes, I feel the same way about the word aliens. I must say, in a way, it sounds rather unfriendly. Anyway, to sum up, your book then embraces the teachings of the Masters of the Wisdom, but you also bring in the early teachings of George Adamski as well.
I actually compare, you could say, or draw parallels between the teachings of the Masters of Wisdom, which is where George Adamski started, and the teachings that he received from the space people.
Right, the sign, yes, that's lovely. Well, it's been very interesting to talk to you, and you make the immediate future sound very exciting for everybody. So I'm so pleased to have had the opportunity to speak with you.
Pleasure was all mine. Thank you very much, Michael.
Well, you're quite welcome. So I'll announce to my listeners next week's guest, who is going to be Tom Evans. He also is an author, and he has just brought out a book called The Art and Science of Lightbulb Moments, which I interpret as meaning moments of inspiration. He also is very much into the subjects that we talk about on my program. So again, I'm sure that will be an interesting interview. So thank you everyone for being with me. God bless you all, and I hope you can be with me next week. Thank you.